Destination Freedom. Destination Freedom. Dramatizations of the great democratic traditions of the Negro people is brought to you by station WMAQ and the Chicago Urban League as part of the pageant of history and of America's own Destination Freedom. The Chicago Urban League is not only an organization, but a movement for men and women to whom the ideals of human freedom are not something simply to preach about, but something to put into practice. In this joint effort, thousands of Negro and white citizens are daily working together under the guidance of the Urban League to extend to underprivileged members of every race, color, and creed in America not alms, but opportunity, and to eliminate every vestige of fascism and bigotry from our national life. Wherever you may live, and whatever your occupation, you too may become a member of the Chicago Urban League. Simply write a letter or card to the Urban League in care of station WMAQ, Chicago 54, for details on how you may join the mid-century march of Americans towards freedom from want and freedom from fear. It has been proclaimed by the mayor of the city of Chicago and of numerous cities and states throughout the country.
Whereas the second week in February 1950 will mark the 25th anniversary of the observance of Negro History Week in Chicago, and whereas a profound influence has been exerted by the Negro on our country's cultural, political, and economic growth, and these accomplishments reflect the independence of all races and creeds and the development of our democratic heritage. Now, therefore, I, Martin H. Kennelly, mayor of the city of Chicago, do hereby proclaim the period from February 12th to 19th, 1950, as Negro History Week in Chicago.
And in keeping with the spirit of this proclamation, Destination Freedom today brings you the story of the founder of Negro History Week, Carter G. Woodson, in a chapter entitled Recorder of History.
My name is Carter G. Woodson. I founded Negro History Week. I was constantly looking back, like Lot's wife. Only what I saw did not turn me into a pillar of salt. What I saw was history, the history of a fighting people, hidden and buried like a pirate's treasure. Hidden so deep, I never dreamed that one day I would go out and search for it. For you see, in the year 1892, when I, Carter G., the ninth child of James and Anne Woodson, helped gather in the crop of summer corn, all I could see in the past was the hard slave life of an ex-slave, my father.
Carter! Carter!
My father, tall, thin, and with the marks of hard weather and harder work etched on his brown flesh, calling my attention to something away down the road.
I say, lay out the baskets in front of the house. Mr. McWheel's coming.
All the family stopped work in the field and squinted their eyes. The name McWheel belonged to only one man in Virginia. The man who had, three decades before, owned as property another man who now stood free and tall beside his nine children, watching the speck of dust advancing down the road.
Are you sure? You sure they'll be him dead?
Only him.
The crop will pay him off, won't it, Dad? It's the best crop we had in three seasons. It's enough, ain't it?
It should be, Robert. Now, you children, I'll do the talking to him. Keep your mouths shut and your heads cool. All he owns is a mortgage on the farm. Nothing else. The crops can cover the payment on that. It's all he'll need.
It's not all he'll want. You know that, Jim.
It's all he'll get.
What's to stop him?
Robert Henry, remember what I said to do?
Sure, Dad. Sure. I'll sit inside with a rifle, just in case.
I saw the nose of my brother's rifle resting on the windowsill, and the wheels of a glistening buggy were turning off the road, coming up to the house. A wagon with three men was behind it. My eyes were on the buggy, for inside that buggy rode a living link that my father had with the past. I waited to see what manner of man had once held my father in slavery, and who now held lien over the land we lived on. When the buggy came up, only a short, heavy-set man with a red beard got out.
Well, well, Jim, I see you're ready for me. Crops all collected?
Just as you see, Mr. McWill.
Corn. You don't expect to pay off with nothing but corn. Price has gone down. Way down, Jim, I'm afraid.
We raised quite a bit of top-grade tobacco this year. Those stacks there. Some more stacks around the side of the house. All in all, it was a good year.
You think so?
What do you think?
Always did think you were a hard-working farmer, Jim. Why, I remember when you were the youngest slave on my plantation. But by George, I got as much work out of you as I did anybody. Why, I remember when your first boy was 6 years old. You came up to the house, right up to the front door, asking if he could learn reading and writing. I said, what on earth a slave want reading and writing for? When all he was ever going to be was a slave anyhow. You remember?
Very well. You were wrong, weren't you?
Some seem to think so. Scalawags and carpetbaggers.
Quite a few slaves thought so, too.
I never cared much about what slaves had in mind. Neither then nor now.
Well, if you'd like to know what I've got in mind now, you'd take your crops and...
I'm sure Mr. McWill's in a hurry to get back. Idle talk slows him up.
I remember when your back talk would get you 10 lashes, maybe 20.
Those days are dead.
Those days will be back, believe me.
Please.
Step aside, girl. Let my men go over the crops and add up the total. Here you boys.
Yes.
Jump down and weigh the crops.
Three men with scales, weights, pencils, and paper jumped down from the wagon and went about the business of counting and stacking the crops. In my mind was the wonder of what it all meant. Why had my father ever been enslaved? How had he been freed? What was the history behind the rise of an ex-master to a place where, once again, he was almost master and could claim all we could squeeze out of the land and pile it upon his wagon and say...
Well, it all totals up, Jim, to just 2/3 of what you owe. You get 1/3 to go.
I'll make it up if it's true.
Who's to deny it? I'll give you a way to make it up. Easy.
Well?
You've got 6 boys, more than you need to farm these acres. Take this boy here. What's your name?
Carter.
Carter? You jump up in the wagon, come over to my place, finish out the year.
For what?
For what you owe me.
I don't hire out my sons.
You don't have any choice. Be thankful one's all I'm asking for. Get up there, Carter.
Stay where you are.
Dad, if it'll help, I don't mind.
You young fool, stay where you are.
All right, you men. Get the boy into the wagon. Go on.
Oh, well, they're going to make me go.
Get up there.
Now. Roll it, Henry.
Well, I see we can't reach a sensible compromise in a sensible way. Let the boy go, Jarrett. What's the meaning of these shots, Jim?
They speak for themselves. I was the slave in the family. My sons remain free. Remember that.
You're living in the past, Jim. Old man Lincoln's dead in his grave. Thaddeus Stevens is just so much dust. Every Yankee soldier's been pulled out of the South. Every Negro soldier's been disarmed. You're living in the past, old man. But I think some of the landowners around here gotten together a band of men who'll bring you up to date. Get on the wagon, boys. Let's go.
They got on the wagon, and he into his buggy. And soon they were waking up the sleeping dust on the sunny Virginia road. And wide awake in my own mind were burning questions about the past. When I asked my father of these things, and why he would rather die than see me work for the ex-master, he shook his head and said...
Once when I was in Washington, I heard old Frederick Douglass say, work without a living wage is slavery.
But isn't slavery done with?
In name. But it's been called by a great many names. They'll call it by a great many more names. You and I and all of us had better wait and see what new form this old monster takes. What new skin this old snake will come forth in before we shout hallelujah.
the short wait for the snake to strike, there was no time to shout hallelujah. The dark of one of the short summer nights hid the sight of men with hoods and robes creeping up to the back of my father's house. In the silence, they set a case of powder under the porch, strung a long fuse down the road, lit it, and left. The dark of that short summer night was ripped open. And the house I lived in was turned into a blazing torch that lit up the skies and was seen for miles around by tenants and landlords, by ex-slaves and ex-masters, and by the Woodson family, gathered on the road, watching as the blaze died down. When the only light was moonlight, my father called a family council.
Listen carefully. Daylight will be here in a few hours. We've got work to do. Mason and Mildred will go down the road to Pine Junction to tell our friends what happened. They'll come back with you. Eileen and Hooker, he'll go towards Richmond, meet with the lumber people, and see if they'll let us have enough lumber to start building.
You're not going to build here again, dear.
It's my land. What better place to build?
Well, some place where we'll be safe.
We'll make this place safe.
Well, they'll kill us. You follow me.
Quiet. Quiet. We stay on the land because it's our home, because I mean to die defending it. Old Nat Turner once said, it's better to die on your feet than live on your knees. Harriet Tubman said, there are two things I've got a right to, and these are death or liberty. One or the other, I mean to have. We quit now, we'd be traitors against the fight my father's made for freedom when even the word was whispered.
He went on detailing his plans, and daylight found him ready to defy the terror that had stalked him at night. But for me, he had other plans.
Carter, come over here.
Yes, sir?
If we get help from the neighbors, the family will have enough hands to get started again. That means you can strike out on your own. If you want to.
Why?
Because the things you're so thirsty for won't be around here for a long time, I'm afraid. You're curious. The only thing that'll satisfy you is education. Here, you don't have a chance. Out on the road, making your own way, that there's a slim chance. You got all your own on your back. Here's a dollar. The road's long and lonesome, but take to it.
With the dollar in my overall pockets, I looked toward the pile of embers that had been my home for 19 years. Then I looked down the long, dusty road that led away, and I followed it through villages and over hills, while the dynamic questions of my life haunted me. Why was I homeless in a land of beautiful homes? Why was I uneducated in a land of compulsory education? Ragged in a country of fine clothes, jobless where workers were wanted, unfree where all were created free and equal. Who was I? Where did I come from? Where was I going? I followed the long road, and it took me into a camp of railroad workers. I watched the men's heavy hammers driving spikes through the heart of the ties until the gang foreman answered one of my questions.
Well, are you out of work?
Yes, sir.
Can you swing a hammer 10 pounds?
Sure.
Here. Hey, Dead Eyes. Yes? Tie that extra hammer over here.
Is this the one you mean, Chief?
It'll do. Grab it, kid, and swing it at this spike.
You see, I can swing it all right.
One blow don't tell the tale. Can you swing it from the beginning of the day to the end's the question.
What time is the beginning?
7 a.m. and no loafing.
What time's the end?
7 p.m. You're on your own. $1.50 a day.
Oh.
Is that going to interfere with your leisure plan?
Well, I did want to register in school after work.
You serious? Look. We're laying down rails too fast for you to light the same school more than one day, and provided we work whether the school will admit Negroes.
Well, I guess I'll have to go on then.
Wait. I like the way you swing that hammer. I need good hammermen. Tell you what I'll do.
Yeah?
I taught school some. I'll teach you the fundamentals between work hours if you'll stick on.
Well,
what can you lose?
Give me the hammer. On the Virginia road, I became married to the steel-driving hammer. And at first, I was too tired in the evenings to study. Finally, it came a time when I was able to keep my eyes open after work long enough to hear the foreman.
Now we'll start with the alphabet. This is A. This is B. This is C. You sleepy?
Oh, no. Go on.
This is D. E.
In the mornings, I hammered home the lessons I'd gotten at night. And when 2 years had rolled by and we had laid 400 miles of track, I had the fundamentals of writing and reading. I was still thirsty, and at the end of the job, the foreman admitted he couldn't fill my cup any longer.
You milked me dry, Carter. I hate to lose a good hammer man, but if you want to be a better student, get into some high school. From there, college. From there...
Yeah?
Well, from there, maybe you can answer some of the questions you ask about what the slave trade meant. What Negroes did in the Revolutionary War. What the Civil War did, all those things.
You don't know anything about that?
Oh, hearsay and folklore. Where the ex-slave tell how things were is a whole lot different from the way some of it's written in the books.
Why should that be?
I don't know.
Is it the truth?
I don't know. I never had time to find out.
I knew I would have time to find out. Even when I walked 70 miles to get my next job in the Virginia coal fields, I found time to stop at the little high school of the mining town to inquire about my favorite subject.
Well, we do teach a bit of history.
I handle the classes myself, Burton.
What is it?
You look mighty big and grown to be just coming into high school.
Well, I had to start late. I've been trying to catch up. Is it all right?
Well, I suppose I can make room for you in the Negro classes. You ever work in the coal mines before?
No.
Maybe you better go over there first, and after you've dug coal a while, then make up your mind about sitting all evening in a school chair.
I went down into the mine shaft and stabbed the anthracite walls in gloomy tunnels with picks, loaded the coal in cars, spent my days in the dark caverns for 6 years as I inched along above ground in the evening classes, forcing my eyes to keep open when my lids felt like lead. Became fascinated with the wide range of knowledge opening before me, and pushed on to make up for lost time. Until one evening, new history textbooks came into the school, and they were passed out in my class.
Now, you'll turn to the chapter on the Civil War and Reconstruction, and read from page 18 to 26. All right. Carter Woodson, will you begin reading? Stand up, please.
A thrill caught my blood as I remembered my own father's struggle to free himself, of the relatives I had who died in revolts, and of stories of the freedmen who had fought for the Union Army. And I thanked God that I'd driven myself to reach a day when I could read of their deeds. But my eyes fell across the pages, and the words were twisted into another kind of story.
The Civil War was a regrettable mistake. On the vast majority of southern plantations, the slaves were happy and carefree and treated with consideration. They did not care for the freedom forced on them by designing abolitionists. Most of the Negroes who grew up as slaves were content with their lot, being well treated and having no fear of poverty. And as for the participation of Negroes in the Civil War, they twanged banjos around the railroad stations, sang melodious spirituals, and believed that some Yankee would soon come along and give each of them 40 acres of land and a mule.
I shook my head in disbelief. But in the days that followed, I read another of the books and another, and they were all grinding out that weird story.
The American Negroes are the only people in the history of the world that became free without any effort of their own.
The Negroes were content in slavery, and would have remained if it hadn't been for Northern interference.
Negroes were not cruelly treated, and it was a travesty upon nature to give them equality with the white people of the South.
book after book spoke out to condone the slave system and to berate its victims. Over and over in the cold pits, I asked myself, was this history? Why was the truth as I had known it, and as my father had known it, twisted and changed? One evening, when I left the mines and was walking home, someone tried to answer me.
Mr. Woodson?
It was the principal. I had avoided her class for weeks.
Mr. Woodson?
Ma'am, I'm sorry I missed class, but since I've finished the course,
You didn't finish. You quit.
Well,
I've gone through those history books. I understand why you left.
Well, I never could understand those books. Why do they lie?
Because in this state, they don't dare print the truth about the Negro's role in American history. If they did, in one generation, school children would grow up hating segregation and race discrimination, and those who profit by prejudice would have the ground shaken under them like an earthquake.
I see. Then, when will you stop teaching your children from books that distort the truth?
When someone writes better books.
This gray-haired teacher's words led me to leave the cold fields and to go north to school to learn to write a better book. I studied at the universities of Chicago and Pittsburgh, Paris and the Philippines. And I pushed my studies further until one day in Chicago in 1915, I joined with a dozen men and women who saw that the contributions of the Negro people to American life had been overlooked, ignored, and suppressed in history and textbooks, and who with me formed the Association for the Study of Negro Life and History to bring these facts before the public. And into the Washington office of the Association came a man from one of the world's largest endowment foundations.
Just what kind of facts do you intend putting before the people, Dr. Woodson? We know research groups such as yours need to be subsidized. My foundation sent me here to examine your program.
And what do you think of it?
If it doesn't go off in the wrong direction, we think the idea is fine. In fact, we're prepared to grant you $25,000 to continue your research.
Well, thank you, Mr. Stokes.
Just a minute, Mr. Woodson. You're writing a book on West Africa, is that true?
I'm leaving for Africa next week to study.
We thought so. You see, our foundation wanted to spare you that trip.
Why so?
Only because our own investigators have already been sent to that part of Africa. We've gotten all the facts we need.
But I haven't gotten all of the facts I need. You see,
I see you're determined to write this book on West Africa.
Certainly.
Well, we'll suppose it's all right, but Dr. Woodson, remember...
Yes?
Many of the contributors to our foundation own some of the mines in that part of Africa. We'd prefer that you overlook these in your report.
I don't quite understand what you're driving at.
We will grant the $25,000, and I'm sure you'll understand.
I understood that there were vested interests who had much in Africa to hide. And after I had spent years studying the life and customs of the people and reporting in books on the monopolies and empires that were squeezing the Africans into colonial slums, I came home to my association. My benefactor visited me.
We've just read your book on the current history of West Africa, Dr. Woodson.
What do you think of it?
We think it's a deliberate attempt to incite the natives to rebellion against the holders of our company.
I'm sorry you think so, but the fact...
I'm sorry, too. The foundation is hereby canceling all grants for research to your association. Hereafter, you'll find your facts without biting the hands that feed you.
But the hands that fed my foundation for the study of Negro history continue to be bitten whenever they reached for fiction instead of the truth. And while the donations slowed down the facts on Negro life, in America, uncovered by scientific investigation, by digging and probing, sifting and weighing, continue to grow. Still, some of the contributors of the association continue to be disturbed, as was my last heavy contributor, a gentleman from a state where nearly half the population was Negro, yet their deeds and history had not been in a single textbook.
Good evening. Good evening, Dr. Woodson.
Good evening, Senator.
Haven't much time, and this matter can be cleared up very shortly.
Yes?
As you know, because of my sincere love for the Negro race, I've been a steady contributor to your association. Out of the sweet memories of all the colored folks who served my family through slavery until today.
Go on, Senator.
For that reason, I want to question the so-called facts about my state you've been printing in your journal, like this claim that our educational system was set up by the Negroes during Reconstruction, that half of the state's wealth been produced by Negroes. Dr. Wilson, just what is behind these claims you keep digging up?
Just the attempt, Senator, to lift the truth about the Negro people above the level of fantasy, mythology, wish fulfillment, and bigotry, and into the realm of fact. We're publishing another bulletin about your state. Now, if you care to see it,
I think I already know enough. Doctor, if you don't have enough on hand to pay for these bulletins, you better cancel them. I'm canceling my donations to the association.
And slowly the rich donators who had peeked into the life of the Negro people out of curiosity, seeking novelty instead of knowledge, dwindled when the iron facts were uncovered. And after bleak years, when no funds came in to help the association remain alive, I went down to the office to close it and to disband it. But I found a letter in the mailbox.
Dear Doctor, perhaps you've forgotten the teacher who taught you history in this coal mining town, but you didn't forget to write the better book. I've used your books in my classrooms, and they've produced an amazing understanding and sense of fellowship between Negro and white students. Because of this, I'm sending you all I can afford, my check for $2,000. Good luck. May you continue to bring forth better books on Negro history.
It kept the association going, and it gave me a new idea. Heretofore, I had been depending for the bulk of the money upon great foundations. It now seemed the time to give the little people a chance to have a part in our project. And it worked. We found the money through many small donations, and we brought forth more books and more facts. And soon students throughout America demanded that there be a week within the year set aside to stimulate the study of Negro history. And so was born Negro History Week. Yes, I am the founder of Negro History Week. I am the historian who looked back to uncover the treasure of Negro life so that America's goal of equality and justice today may be strengthened by the knowledge of their struggle for freedom in the past.
You have just heard Destination Freedom's dramatization of Recorder of History, the story of Dr. Carter G. Woodson, the founder of Negro History Week. Now, of course, the Urban League of Chicago is a top authority in this field. For many years, it has been in the forefront of the struggle for better race relations. All over the nation, the Urban League, its staff and its members, have been making history in every sense of the word. If you would like to participate in this great movement, send a card or letter to the Urban League, care of WMAQ, Chicago 54, for full particulars. Destination Freedom is written by Richard Durham and produced under the direction of Homer Heck. The role of Dr. Woodson was played by Oscar Brown, Jr. Others were Weslin Tilden, Maurice Copeland, Jack Lester, Fred Pinkard, and Bob White. The special music was composed by Emil Soderstrom and played by Elwin Owen and Jose Bethencourt. Sound effects were by Cliff Mueller and Dave Squires. Your engineer was Gary DeVlee. This is Charles Martin inviting you to join us again next week when Destination Freedom will present a special Brotherhood Week program, including tape recordings of interviews with people of many races who have demonstrated that the principles of brotherhood can work. This is NBC, the National Broadcasting Company.